Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Richie Neal, the Senate has come out with a blast of a report about, you know, basically there's no way to change it, America's ethics in torturing its prisoners. What do you make of it?
Well, certainly as it's reviewed, you come to the conclusion that it's inconsistent with the ideal that we suggest to the world about America. And you can see how carefully staged the rollout was and then how carefully staged the opposition was. So we're going to spend, I believe, the next couple of days sorting through much of the evidence that has been reported. Senator Feinstein, she thought that this was information that needed to make its way to the public. And I think that the most important pivot point here for everybody to understand is the following. The suggestion was made that by using torture, we were securing additional data that was keeping us safe. And that is readily in dispute based upon the report as it was published. And as you know, former Vice President Cheney has indicated that it did keep us safe, but there are 20 cases that have been reviewed by the Senate committee. And understanding that 11 members of that committee against three voted to publish that document, so there was bipartisan support, including Senator McCain, who took a very harsh view of the torture that was suggested in the report. And the ideal, again, was that somehow America didn't do these things. And if we ever had to do things, it was under this great stress that would allow us to secure necessary information. Apparently, in the 20 cases that the Senate committee reviewed, that did not happen.
I think one of the most interesting things you just referenced, John McCain, you know, is his point. Here's a guy who was tortured by the Vietnamese when he was captured. You know, his point in the past has been, hey, if we do it, they'll do it. It just encourages the cycle. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that he's really been a sole voice on the Republican side now for at least 20 years in his opposition to torture. And for the 5 years that he spent in a Hanoi prison where he was tortured almost on a daily basis, he's the best witness, I think, to offer that testimony. The question is, I think, pervasive. Do these enhanced techniques, this use of rendition, do they really secure additional data? And McCain said they don't, and the Democratic majority on that committee said they don't. And that's the key phrase.
How much of the information do you think the American people deserve? I mean, right now there's a big fight as we speak going on about releasing all the background data and everything else that has been, you know, subpoenaed or otherwise garnered by the committee here. How much do we deserve to have, even if it might conceivably put somebody at risk?
Well, I think that there has to be a balance that is struck. I think there's the age-old argument that the public has a right to know, and surely they do. And I think that there are those in national security that would argue pretty vociferously it's a question of when they have a right to know it. And I think you're looking at information now, for example, with these torture techniques that were utilized that really date to around 2004. So I think that that's a very important consideration.
Now, Richie Neal, the Republicans have taken the Senate. Are we looking at dark times according to the way you see the world?
Well, I think that you're ending the 2 years of the Obama administration in a more perilous course. The president has outlined essentially a couple of priorities that he has going forward. What's noteworthy is how much the budget picture has improved. What's noteworthy is how much the jobs picture has improved. And that, in and of itself, you think would give some prompting to continue on this course. The problem is that the administration has suggested that they are going to proceed with these executive orders, and the Republicans have said that that's working outside the guidelines of legislation and the law. So you're going to see, I think, some resistance from Republicans in the Senate and a substantially improved number of Republicans in the House of Representatives. So I think there's some room here, as the president reports, for some activity on the trade front. I think that there's going to be some room here for budgeting. And I think that clearly, I think the president will take the opportunity at some juncture to speak to the issue of racial relations in America. So my hunch is that there could be some reconciliation, but I wouldn't expect any big things to get done over the next couple of years.
There's a good deal of animus now. And I think what I hear you suggesting is that because they now have the responsibility of not only being the loyal opposition but in power, that maybe they'll be more reasonable?
Well, example, tax reform is something that looms. And when you consider tax reform, everybody is in broad agreement that the current tax system in America is not competitive. It's inefficient, and it places us in a very difficult situation vis-a-vis our counterparts across much the rest of the globe. At the same time, as long as that discussion is kept generic, everybody agrees on the problem. The difficulty is, what do you do about the solution? Now, the president has opened the door by saying that he wants to attack the corporate rate in America, take it from 35 to 28. Republicans have said that they want to take it to 25. So I think there is some room there, and understanding that the corporate rate that America utilizes, in fact, is very uncompetitive when you relate it to what happens to our European neighbors, for example.
On the other hand, some major corporations, one right around here, pay nothing in taxes. So there must be a lot of loopholes that would
Well, I think that's the trade-off. I think to get full tax reform and get our tax system in a justifiable manner, I think the argument that you really want to use is, let's close down the loopholes to lower the rates. I think that's a very, very fair assessment of the situation.
But when we do, and you're a real expert on this, maybe the best in Congress, when we do, certainly the Republicans will start to ask for some of the tax programs that are very favorable to many of the middle-class people who elect to Congress, like, for example, the mortgage deduction.
Well, the mortgage deduction is not going away. I can assure you of that. I think that that is, in fact, a middle-class benefit. But not to miss the point, one of the difficulties with the mortgage deduction is that it's really utilized on the two coasts of America rather than on the in the heartland of America.
Is that right?
And that's because people generally in the heartland, they don't do itemized deductions.
Uh-huh. Why is that? I mean, why wouldn't they use the itemized deduction? Do they not make enough money to do it, to make it
work? Yeah, that would be part of it. They don't make enough money, and nor do they have a very complicated tax form that they're required to submit to the IRS.
Wow. Let me take the last couple of minutes here on Deval Patrick. He is leaving as governor. He gets generally very high marks, yet a Republican replaces him. What do you make of that?
Well, I've known him now for the 8 years that he's been governor. I must tell you, he's been very good to Western Massachusetts. He's amongst us every conceivable moment. I've developed a very strong relationship with him, and he's been very good on a number of initiatives, including one in Springfield called Union Station, where he's been very helpful to me. I've been at that for more than three decades, and I've put a lot of federal money into it. And as we came down the home stretch, Governor Patrick was very helpful at just putting in the last piece of the puzzle. And I also think that the Massachusetts economy never really got hit the way that the rest of the country did. Now, we took our lumps, not to be mistaken about that. But I thought that Governor Patrick pretty much maintained a favorable rating with the public because I thought that he offered competent government. Now, second part of your question is that in Massachusetts, despite all the talk, as you know, about Democrats and Republicans, 54% of the voters are suburban independents. They overwhelmingly determine these elections now. And with in the case of Martha Coakley, I think that she lost only 19% of the Democrats, but Charlie Baker received almost 100% of the 11% of Republicans who vote. And overwhelmingly, it was independents that put him in the driver's seat. So there is a very important issue to be mindful of in Massachusetts, and that is that the independent who does not like excitable language, they want solutions, and they tend to be fairly liberal on social issues, but fairly conservative on issues of taxation, they are the ones who overwhelmingly show up on Election Day now. And the other part of it, Alan, that I think is fascinating and worthy of a discussion that's lengthy is that the turnout now in the old cities versus the turnout in the suburbs has been one of the most substantial changes in my career.
And when we come back, Richie Neal, I'm going to start with that very question, okay?
Thanks very much, Alan.